Last Sunday I watched a program on the TV that some of you may have seen about a man in Queensland who claims to be Jesus. Through the web, the internet, he has now got a following of tens of thousands of people throughout the world. And he also has a very strong following in that part of Queensland where he has set up his little hideaway there. Now here is a guy who reckons that from an early age he had experienced or he felt many of the things that Jesus had experienced, like crucifixion. And he has, in his words, experienced the miracles that Jesus did. And because of that, he claims now that he was Jesus 2,000 years ago in a past life. And that he is Jesus living on earth again today. And I guess the thing that really got to me was that his followers in Australia, many of whom were shown in his big hall listening to his every word, could have been a congregation in a church anywhere in Australia. They were normal Aussies. They were from little kids right out to senior people and everyone in between. It could have been any church in Australia, but here they were passionately believing the claim that this man made, that he was Jesus. And the fact that he had come was a sign that the end of the world was near, and in him, and only in him, was deliverance. Now, I must admit, I felt quite disturbed, quite cross, and also upset by that report. And yet, he's just one of many, through 2,000 years, who have claimed that they are Jesus. I remember, well, I suppose over 20 years ago, in the Western Australian, a big picture of a man in England who claimed that he was Jesus. He was the Messiah and the world was about to end. That was a number of years ago now, so it obviously didn't happen. But there's always been those people, and there will always be those people, and they will lead up and they will deceive many. And that's what Jesus said would happen. He warned us to expect imposters, to expect pretenders. In that passage that we've looked at in Mark 13, Jesus says this in verse 5 to 6. He's responding to the question of his disciples. Watch out. The word watch is at the beginning. You notice that the chapter ends with the word watch. Obviously, that's what Jesus wants to get across, that we need to watch. We need to be on our guard. Watch out that no one deceives you. Many will come in my name, claiming I am he, and will deceive many. And then again in verses 21 and 22, at that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or look, there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform signs and miracles to deceive the elect, if that were possible. But as well as warning his listeners, his followers, his disciples to beware pretenders, Jesus also told us how we would know that they were pretenders. And in Mark 13, 26, this same chapter, he lets us know that when he returns, it will not be as a human being living again the life that he once lived here on earth. That mission is completed. He's done that. That work has been done. Does not need to be done again. But he will return as the Almighty One in power and in majesty, and every eye will see him. Verse 26 says, at that time men will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And he will send his angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heavens. And there are many other verses in the New Testament that supplement this verse and back it up. Verses from Luke and Matthew. There's a verse from Revelation 1:7. Look, he is coming with the clouds, and every eye will see him, even those who pierced him, and all the peoples of the earth will mourn because of him. So shall it be. Amen. Now, it's important that we have a knowledge of these verses. For, you know, if a friend asks us, and perhaps a friend has asked you this week, what do you think of that guy in Queensland who reckons that he's Jesus? In that case, you can take them to the words of Jesus himself about his coming again in the Bible and show how absolutely world-changing this event will be. It won't be a little thing. It will be the end. And it will be glorious, and it will be mighty. Nothing like what's happening in Queensland. But there's a lot more at stake in Matthew chapter 13 than just a warning about those who pretend to be the Christ. It also contains teaching for Christians on how we should live in this age before he comes again. And they're things that Jesus wants us to know beforehand so that we should not be surprised when certain things happen. And I think this is more important. And neither should we be fearful when things are said and predictions are made. So straight away we see that Mark chapter 13 is a very vital chapter for Christians. Vital chapter for us to read and to understand. But there's a problem. It's a really difficult chapter to get a grip of. Didn't you feel that when Don read it? Is it one of those you kind of avoid a little? Or you may get obsessed with one or the other? One writer says of this chapter, "Welcome to the most complex and difficult chapter of Mark. One that causes even world-class scholars to toss up their hands and admit, we can't tell for certain what Jesus means." It begins when four guys ask Jesus when the temple will be destroyed. Jesus begins addressing them, but ends addressing everyone. His lecture seems to cover not only the temple, but also the end of human history. The trick is in figuring out which of his sentences refer to which topic. And that's not easy. I wonder whether you've ever been in a conversation with someone, a friend, and you've found yourself speaking about two entirely different things at the same time. Now, you and the friend know exactly what you're talking about. But if a third person happened to come in on that conversation and stood listening, they would be completely confused. Well, that's what's happening here in Mark chapter 13. Jesus has responded to a question about the destruction of the temple, but also another question about the end of the age. And he goes from one subject to another, and then back to the other one again throughout the chapter. It begins with this most startling prediction that Jesus made about the most amazing building in Jerusalem. We have no concept, I don't think, what the temple really looked like. In the sense of seeing it. We've got plans and things, but you actually see it. It was amazing. We call it a temple, but in fact it was made up of several buildings. The buildings themselves that connected to the temple covered about 1/6 of the total area that was the city of Jerusalem within the walls. And it was made up of these amazing great stones. I don't know if you've got a study Bible. Those of you who've got a study Bible, you might like to look at your study Bible and see if it's got a little note about verse 2, because it probably has. The little note in my Bible says, "Massive stones. According to Josephus, who was a historian at that time, they were white and some of them were 37 feet long, 12 feet high and 18 feet wide." I can't imagine that. That's a couple of small rooms. That's what Josephus said, who wrote at that time. Now, when Jesus said, and you look at his prediction, "Do you see all these great buildings?" replied Jesus. "Not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." You can imagine how the disciples thought, that's incredible, that surely can't happen. You see, the Jews had this belief at the time. They believed that the temple was the centre of the universe. Well, it had to be. That's where God lived. That's where God dwelt. That's where God came and revealed himself. And so they also believed that if the temple was destroyed, then that would just herald the end of this age. The two would happen at the same time. So in some trepidation, you find Jesus' closest friends, they take Jesus aside privately. And they ask him, when will the temple be destroyed? And what signs will precede the end of the age? They got the two together because they believed that the two things would happen at the same time. There's another passage in Matthew 24:3, a corresponding passage, which makes it a little clearer with the question that they asked. Tell us, when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? So they put the two together. Now we know from history that they got that wrong. Jesus knew it then. You see, the temple that was so wonderful, so great, so big, was destroyed by the Romans in AD 70. It's about 36 years after the resurrection of Jesus. The Lord's return and the end of the age is obviously still to come. So Jesus treating these as two different occasions begins to answer these disciples by addressing the part of the question that refers to the end of the age first. And by saying in verse 5, watch out that no one deceives you. That's how he begins. The disciples wanted to know signs. What is the sign of the end of the age? They wanted to be ready. They wanted to know signs so they would know when Jesus was coming and they could get everything done before he arrived. They wanted that, some sort of a timetable. Now when this happens, great, we get in there. And that, and that, and that. Just a little bit of a lead up to it so we can be ready. And it's a human trait, isn't it? We want to know the type of thing, big thing like that, in advance. But what Jesus says is there won't be those specific and unique signs that they wanted. In fact, he says this, right in verse 32. Whoops, go backwards. No one knows about that day or hour. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard. Be alert. Watch again. You do not know when that time will come. And yet, having said that, Jesus knew that throughout the ages, there will be those deceivers who will claim that the end is about to happen. Because they see the signs, of course, and they know. And they will point to certain things as definite signs of it. They'll point to wars or a particular war as a sign. They'll point to earthquake or a particular earthquake as a sign or a famine. Some will think that they know more than Jesus knows and will even come up with an actual date. How arrogant that is when even the Son doesn't know that. So Jesus says in verse 7, when you hear of wars and rumours of wars, do not be alarmed. Such things must happen. They will go on through this age. But the end is still to come. In other words, don't get into a real tither when people start pointing at this or that disaster as a sign that Jesus is on his way. And don't spend heaps of time trying to work out things that you can come up with as a possible date. Because you won't know it. In fact, Jesus goes on to say that this age that we live in now, this age we call the age of grace, a lot of terrible things will happen throughout it. And worse things, including persecution of believers. And they will happen throughout this time between the resurrection and his return. See, Jesus doesn't promise Christians in this age of grace a rosy life. Just because you're a Christian and you're good, don't think that you're going to get it easier than others. You may even get it harder than others. God will always be with you. But he doesn't promise you this rosy life. If you look at it here, in fact, it's at times quite alarming. But the promise he does give is this in verse 13, that he or she who stands firm to the end, and the word for end used here suggests the end of one's life rather than the catastrophic end of the age, they will be saved. That's his promise to you. So whatever you're going through now, yeah, it's going to be tough, but you stand firm because there's something glorious ahead of you. That's his biggest promise to you. The blessed life for the believer is still to come and will come. So having dealt with the moment, with the part of the question about the end time, he addresses their first question about when the temple will be destroyed. And that was an important one to them. And he does so in verses 14 to 23. And he begins with a prophecy from the book of Daniel that has made scholars talk for months and months and years and years and years and study, and no doubt will continue to do so. When you see the abomination that causes desolation standing where it does not belong, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Now everybody seems to accept that this refers to something really horrible and blasphemous set up in the Holy of Holies in the temple. Something really sacrilegious. Something that dishonours God as nothing else can dishonour God. And most see that as that's what it means. But when? That's the problem. There are many, and perhaps you're amongst them, and that's okay, who see it as something that is still to happen and connect it with the Antichrist. And we look at 2 Thessalonians 2 and we see something about that there. But there's also something that Jesus is saying in the context here. And in the context of the passage, when you look at the passage, it refers to something that will happen before that temple was destroyed. What it refers to is a terrible thing that took place in the temple in Jerusalem just before the Romans destroyed Jerusalem in AD 70. See, there's these Jewish zealots. You might have heard of the zealots. One of Jesus' disciples was a zealot. The zealots were a group who were fanatical. And they wanted the Romans out of their land. As well as that, they wanted to change those who ruled the temple. Because they didn't agree with the high priest, the way of doing things. They weren't so much religious as nationalistic. The zealots became gradually more powerful in the second half of that first century. In AD 66, they became quite powerful. And they were able to push the Romans out of Jerusalem. And they slaughtered many of them. They also took over the temple, got rid of the high priests, and they made the temple their fort. This temple, this holy place, became their fort. And the very Holy of Holies was just another room to them that they used for storage and stuff. They even took prisoners of war and murdered them in the temple itself. And then they appointed one of their guys, who was a bit of a clown, so we're told, as high priest. A fake high priest. He made a mockery of it. And he began to do things in the Holy of Holies and in the temple that were sacrilegious and blasphemous. But the interesting thing is that that Jewish historian, who was a secular Jewish historian, Josephus, writes that at that time, when those things started to happen, suddenly the Christians started to move. He says the Christians saw that as a sign of what that Jesus had spoken about. And they fled. They did what Jesus told them to do in these verses from verse 14 onwards. They fled. They fled for the hills. Not the hills of Judea, but beyond the hills to a little mountain town called, in those days, Pella. And that's where they were safe. Otherwise they would have been wiped out. It wasn't long after the Christians had gone out of Jerusalem that a Roman general named Titus marched thousands of battle-hardened centurions into Jerusalem and they slaughtered the Jews. It was a huge act of vengeance. And they rushed moved through and slaughtered the Jews that remained. They burnt the temple. You see what happened? The zealots for a last-ditch stand, went into the temple and closed a huge door of the temple. They didn't think they could be got there. The Romans surrounded it, and Titus ordered that they be burnt with the people inside, but with an intense heat, as hot as they could get it. Of course, they killed all the people inside. At the same time, the gold of the roof of the temple melted, and it ran down into the bricks, into the mortar. And then the Romans chipped away at that mortar and moved the bricks, moved these massive stones so they could get the gold, until there wasn't a stone left upon another. Now you can understand why Jesus said to his disciples, "So be on your guard. I have told you everything ahead of time." And then in verse 24, Jesus returns again to the subject of his return at the end of time, letting us know that his return will be accompanied by darkness, where the moon and the sun and the stars will give no light, and the Son of Man will return, well, of course, with great, massive light, for he is the light of the world. And it will come in great power, a glorious day of deliverance for the believers who will be gathered, the scripture says, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heavens. And that day will most certainly come. Jesus got it right about the temple. He definitely got it right about his end when he returns. And it will be unexpected and absolutely glorious. But for now, you and I, are living in this world. And it's a world where evil is so prevalent. And we've got to live here and use well whatever opportunity God gives us to share his love with others. And it's not going to be easy, because the powers of evil are against us. And it may not be easy for you as a Christian to live where you live. It may not be easy for you as a Christian to work where you work, to care and share with some that cross your path or seem to be given to you to speak to, and yet they're perhaps hard for you to do so. At times, life may seem fraught with difficulties and obstacles. Jesus predicted such times for believers, so don't be surprised if they happen. But God not only cares for us, but has a purpose for us that fits us like a glove. You know, no one else can do or be where God has put you. No one. And consequently, the thing that Jesus tells us to do again and again in this chapter is to watch, to be on guard, to guard against deception, to guard against evil outside and that stirs up within, to guard against the attacks that will come upon you, insidious ones, ones you won't even recognize, and to guard against slipping away from him, his love, his power, his mission, his work, his fire in you. And it's that which makes the closing words of Jesus in this chapter so pertinent to his disciples and to us this morning. It's a last little parable, a last little story he tells. And with this I finish. It's 13:35-37. This is how the message puts it. So stay at your post. At your post. Not my post, your post. I've got to stay at my post. Stay at your post watching. You have no idea when the homeowner is returning, whether evening, midnight, cockcrow, or morning. You don't want him showing up unannounced with you asleep on the job. I say it to you, and I'm saying it to all. Stay at your post. Keep watch. Know the Lord. Be sure you know him. Live out for the Lord every day by his Spirit. Stay at your post and keep watch.